Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Elizabeth. I will be reading to you from the Lowell Sun, dated Friday, March 6th. Headline, Lowell man charged with aggravated child rape. Years of abuse claimed, new allegations serve stirring probe. This is by Aaron Curtis, Lowell Sun, Lowell. A Lowell man has been charged with aggravated rape of a child after a girl known to the defendant told police he abused her for years. The Lowell District Court documents state that during the course of the investigation, additional allegations surfaced accusing Alex Castellano, 48, of abuse involving others known to him that had never been disclosed to law enforcement. Castellano, meanwhile, has denied the allegations, saying during an interview with investigators that the girl made the accusations for attention, according to the Lowell Police Incident Report. He has since posted $5,000 cash bail. The allegations were brought to light on December 10th when the alleged victim's father told police that his daughter had disclosed sexual abuse involving Castellano. According to the police report, the father said he had been approached by another family member and his daughter for a sit-down discussion with him and the girl's mother. With the help of the other family member, the girl allegedly told her father that Castellano had been abusing her since she was 5. The girl's name and age were redacted from the report. 8 days later, on December 18th, members of the Lowell Police, the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, the State Department of Children and Families, and a forensic interviewer conducted a video and audio recorded interview with the girl. She alleged to the investigators that the first incident of abuse occurred during a sleepover at Castellano's home on Chelmsford Street when he invited her to his room to watch a movie. She described another incident in his vehicle while he took her to stores. During both incidences, the two were alone. He would ask her questions about school and she would respond, and she stated he didn't discuss anything about what he was doing to her and didn't tell her not to tell anyone, the report states, adding the girl said she felt uncomfortable. The girl told investigators during the meeting that she was previously afraid to say anything because Castellano has anger issues, according to the report. She said, however, that a friend recently urged her to tell someone, prompting her to come forward. She said the abuse continued until she was 10 or 11 a few times a month. The alleged victim described the last incident of abuse at Castellano's home, saying during the meeting that she told him to stop and kicked him as he held her down. She said she yelled for another family member who was in the house, ran away, and locked herself in a room. The girl said that this was the last time he abused her. As the investigation continued on December 23rd, an adult known to the defendant alleged she too had been sexually assaulted by Castellano when she was in her teens, though the incident had never been reported. authorities Authorities also interviewed Castellano's longtime partner, who described his relationship with the children known to him as positive, saying he was like a kid, not a disciplinarian. She said the children would dislike him whenever they witnessed arguments between the two adults, but otherwise they respected and loved him, according to the report. She also said she and Castellano sometimes got into arguments that turned physical, but she did not report those incidents to police and declined to provide further details during the interview. She told the investigator that she was called to a meeting where the allegations were first discussed and she blacked out from anger when she heard them, the report says. Castellano's partner also said she had previously been approached about the alleged sexual abuse involving a now adult who also came forward but never addressed the incident with Alex, wanting to keep peace, the report says. On February 19th, Castellano was advised of his rights and agreed to speak with the police. During a recorded interview, he told investigators children known to him were often at the home where he frequently wrestled with them. His partner had pointed out during her interview that Castellanos practices martial arts. As the children got older, Castellano said he stopped wrestling with them. He adamantly denied the allegations against him, the report states. When asked why he thought the juvenile would lie, he stated maybe for attention. When asked if the victims was known to be trustworthy, he told investigators that to other kids, she was not, but him, she was. In a statement emailed to The Sun, Castellano's attorney, Jamal Arouri, reiterated that his client maintains his innocence. Mr. Castellano has pled not guilty, and he adamantly denies the charges against him. He is an extremely hardworking individual who has been gainfully employed his entire life. He is a person of integrity and trusted member of the community. He was fully cooperative with the police investigation in this matter. We have no doubt that these charges are presented to jury of his peers. He will be exonerated. Castellano was arrested on February 19th and arraigned the following day. He was held without bail pending a dangerousness hearing, which took place on February 26th. According to court documents, after the hearing, a judge set bail at $5,000, which he posted the same day. Before his release, Castellano was fitted with a GPS tracking device and placed on home confinement from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m., work-related curfew. He was also ordered to surrender his passport and avoid contact from the alleged victim and have no unsupervised contact with minors. Aggravated rape of a child includes a potential prison sentence of at least 10 years. Castellano was scheduled to return to court for a probable cause hearing on April 28th. Under the microscope, Moulton's SOTU guest cited in cops reports, police say. This is by Tim Dunn of the Boston Herald. Congressman Seth Moulton's illegal immigrant guest during the State of the Union address is referenced in police reports involving sexual assault and juvenile, police say. The Herald submitted a public records request to the State Secretary of State's office and the Milford Police Department regarding two reports, one from June and the other from September 2021, where Marcelo Gomes da Silva was apparently named as a person of interest. The Herald sought the police report numbered 21-23101 dated September 15th, 2021, featuring Marcelo Gomes da Silva, and 1-16254, dated June 30th, 2021, also featuring the 19-year-old. Milford Deputy Chief John Cinchoni denied both of the requests, indicating that the police report from June 2021 involves a sexual assault and juveniles, and that the report from September 2021 involves juveniles. He did not elaborate. The deputy chief simply wrote, "The records you are requesting are not public records in accordance with MGL C4S7CL26A. Report 21-23101-OF involves assault and juveniles. Report 21-16254-OF involves juveniles." Moulton brought Gomes de Silva to the State of the Union address on February 24th as a guest in a highly publicized trip around earlier in the month. Moulton had posted on social media that he had allowed Gomes de Silva to hide in his office after the speech early due to the social media posts about him by the Department of Homeland Security. Gomes de Silva is an illegal alien who has no right to be in our nation. We are committed to enforcing the law and fighting for arrest, detention, and removal of aliens like him, said DHS in a post on X about Moulton's guest. A spokesperson for Congressman Moulton told CBS News, "The decision to escort Gomes de Silva out of the House gallery was made out of an abundance of caution due to the DHS targeting and harassing Marcello." In an appearance on MSN Now, following the address, Moulton called Gomes de Silva a great American, a patriot, and a reminder of what courage looks like. "We all know Marcello because of a tragic immigration story where he was thrown into a detention facility for days on end, sleeping on a concrete floor and not even given a Bible. Yet throughout the time he insisted on helping others, was more focused on translating for other detainees and helping them contact their families than even his own safety," Moulton said. "He wanted to come here and confront not just Donald Trump at the State of the Union, but the MAGA Republican enablers who are my colleagues here in the House of Representatives, and he did that. He put a human face on the immigration tragedy, and what I think so many colleagues saw is not just an immigrant, but an American, a great young American, amazing patriot whose courage we should all emulate in these challenging times." Following his visit to Capitol Hill, Gomes de Silva recently testified on Beacon Hill in support of a proposed legislation to ban ICE agents from making civil immigration arrests in state courthouses and on other state-owned property. The bill would also ban sheriff's departments from entering into any new 287G agreements in Massachusetts. "It's very important to note that a lot of kids that are growing up in our community now are going to build some type of anger towards ICE, not towards ICE itself, but towards anyone they deem to be working with them. We should note that a lot of people are really nervous and scared about police officers, and a lot of people don't want to go off to work. I think it's important for our community to go out and be able to build a better economy and work," Gomes de Silva said while testifying before the House Committee on Public Safety and Homeland Security on the PROTECT Act. Gomes de Silva was held for nearly a week at ICE's Boston Burlington facility in May after agents detained him while he was driving his father's car. ICE had been searching for de Silva's father, a habitual traffic offender, via speeding violations on behalf of local law enforcement when they took him into custody. Both Moulton and de Silva have claimed he was treated inhumanely during his detainment, saying he was denied basic necessities, including access to a shower and a bed to sleep in. Moulton conducted an oversight tour of the ICE Burlington facility back in December to follow up on previous tour he had made in 2025. He told reporters following his December visit that ICE abuses of ICE need to be prosecuted, not just defunded, prosecuted. They needed to be held accountable to the law that they can't claim to enforce. ICE Boston says Moulton and Gomes de Silva's claims are untrue. The situation sparked a highly publicized feud between Moulton and acting ICE director Todd Lyons, who called Moulton's words disgusting and pure theatrical political theater. De Silva was reportedly in the United States on a student visa that had expired unbeknownst to him when he was taken into custody on ICE. An immigration lawyer later granted De Silva a $2,000 bond after determining he was not a danger to the public. Following his release, Gomes De Silva received a wave of sympathetic media coverage and was invited by Governor Maura Healey to tour her office at the State House. Gomes De Silva responded to a request for comment by the Herald through his lawyer. "I would like to respond to the Boston Herald's irresponsible, outrageous reporting. I want to be clear, I never assaulted anyone. I have never been contacted by the police about accusations of an assault," Gomes De Silva said. "I only learned of these reports that allegedly include my name in them through the media. I have never seen these alleged reports. My attorney since requested the alleged reports and was denied." Moulton's spokesman has told the Herald, "According to our review, Marcello has never been charged with a crime." The Herald is appealing both the Milford Juvenile Court and the Milford Police denial of releasing Gomes De Silva's background on the ground Moulton had turned the teen's story into a public debate on ICE enforcement. Out-of-state police access Silicon Valley license plate readers. The company behind a network of automated license plate reading cameras is losing its public safety contracts across Silicon Valley. The Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors is the most recent of officials to join Los Altos Hills and Mountain View in severing ties with Flock Safety over concerns that the company has enabled unlawful data sharing between California law enforcement and out-of-state police. Mountain View officials revealed last month Flock had included their camera network in a national lookup setting without the city's permission, allowing unauthorized law enforcement agencies to access their data. San Jose Spotlight has learned that practice repeated elsewhere in the country. Police in Massachusetts, Georgia, and other states appeared hundreds of times in camera network audit for neighboring Los Altos, whose 18 cameras remain optional. The city's network logged 20 searches by out-of-state police for immigration violation reasons in the first 2 months of 2025, according to records obtained by this news outlet. California law has barred police departments from sharing license plate reading camera data with out-of-state or federal agencies for any reason since 2016. Under Senate Bill 34, the law has been invoked in debates about cameras' use and their role in federal immigration enforcement. "This law looks unlawful," Brian Hoffer, executive director of the Bay Area civil rights group Secure Justice, told San Jose Spotlight. He reviewed multiple camera records at this news outlet's request. "It definitely looks like Los Angeles isn't paying attention." Los Altos officials said Flock had enabled a national and statewide lookup feature on their network of cameras without notifying the city or seeking its permission. Officials said they switched off the setting after discovering it added that they don't believe camera data was unlawfully accessed. One immigration-related search appeared in the Los Altos logs, even though it had set to filter, excluding all networks outside Arizona, according to the data. The network audit identifies all agencies within the broader Flock Safety network during a given period. It does not indicate they had access or search Los Altos specific data. City Manager Gabriel Engelin told San Jose Spotlight. While we believe our data has not been improperly accessed, this can ultimately only be confirmed by Flock. We are limited by the fact that we cannot independently corroborate their internal system logs. Flock safety person Paris Newbel said that the contract cancellations will move public safety backwards and prolong the time it will take to solve criminal cases. We understand communities expect strong guardrails and full compliance with California law, Newbel told San Jose Spotlight. Flock has implemented enhanced safeguards across the state, including disabling the national lookup feature for California agencies, blocking out-of-state discoverability, preventing federal access to California agencies' data, and supporting agencies in auditing and confirming their settings. The Los Altos California Council had already adopted a policy restricting data sharing. In November, the city further restricted its data sharing to police departments in Santa Clara and San Mateo, Alameda, and Santa Cruz counties. The city revoked search approvals for every other California agency outside this four-county boundary, including California Highway Patrol. I am disappointed in some of Flock's business practices that have been out of control, of which we were unaware of, Los Altos Police Chief Saskia Langergren told San Jose Spotlight. I've been frustrated with the lack of transparency by Flock and their lack of communications to their customers about various settings in the system. Santa Clara, unaware, Santa Clara camera logs obtained by this news outlet showed the city's network was included in thousands of searches by the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department for multiple months last year. In March, Santa Clara's network was included in 5,600 out-of-state searches by the Nevada Law Enforcement Agency. There are 80 license plate reading cameras in the city. Santa Clara Police Lieutenant Eric Langergan, who is the Los Altos Police Chief's husband, said Santa Clara wasn't aware of the issue until the searches had been made. He similarly denied the notion that Santa Clara actively shared data with Las Vegas thousands of times. Those logs reflect instances in which a search query included multiple agency networks. Langergan told San Jose Spotlight the audit logs do not show the number of Santa Clara records returned in response to any query, nor do they indicate that Santa Clara data was specifically targeted or transferred in each instance. The February 24th Board of Supervisors vote to cut ties with Flock means the sheriff's office cannot access any images or data from Flock's cameras. Before the vote, the sheriff's office had been operating license plate reading cameras in Los Altos Hills, Cupertino, and Saratoga, which all contract with the sheriff rather than having their own police departments. The Los Altos Hills Town Council voted to remove its cameras prior to the county vote. Some supervisors stood by the use of license plate reader cameras, but couched their concerns solely on Flock as a vendor. This is not an indictment of the sheriff's office. This is not an indictment of our surveillance use policy, District 2 Supervisor Betty Duong said at the meeting. What we have been here is a notice of a bad vendor that all signs are telling us not to get in bed with. District 4 Supervisor Susan Ellenberg differed with her colleagues and took issue with the license plate reading cameras as a whole. Alternative vendors are not necessarily any safer, and we don't know what tomorrow's news will bring about Axon or any other provider, Ellenberg said at the meeting. Immigrants' rights advocates agree. We keep getting told this tech is there to stop crime, to fight crime, but what happens when the definition of crime expands to include dissent. Hugh Tron, Executive Director, Services, Immigrants' Rights and Education Network, or SIREN, told the San Jose Spotlight. SIREN has partnered with Electronic Frontier Foundation and the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California to sue San Jose police for warrantless searches of their 474 Flock cameras. That's the risk we create with a mass surveillance system where the only source of protection is faith in the people who control it, Tron said. A spokesperson for the sheriff's office said it made sure that no national lookup features were enabled on the Flock network, and supervisory staff reviewed camera activity weekly to ensure no access by unauthorized agencies. The sheriff's office is looking for new vendors, the spokeswoman said. We are currently exploring alternative options and will support the cities if they choose to pursue another automated license plate reader vendor, Sergeant Brooks Harrows told San Jose Spotlight. The story was originally published by the San Jose Spotlight and distributed through a partnership with the Associated Press. One recovered, one missing after fishing vessel overturns. This is Boston. A commercial fishing vessel overturned and sunk off Cape Cod on Thursday, leading to one person being pulled from the water and a second crew member still missing, U.S. Coast Guard officials said. The person who was recovered was transported to a higher medical care, Coast Guard spokesperson Kara Chantry said. They did not provide a name nor updates about the two people on the boat. The accident comes just a month after Lily Jean sank off Gloucester, killing all seven aboard. The 72-foot, 22-meter vessel Lily Jean was returning to port early January 30th to repair fishing gear when it sank in the frigid Atlantic waters off the historic fishing port of Gloucester. I'm heartbroken by the news that fishing vessel Yankee Rose was found capsized, and my prayers are with the loved ones of the crew, first responders, and our entire fishing community during this incredibly difficult time, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey said in a statement. This is another devastating reminder of the dangers that come with life at sea and another tragedy for Massachusetts fishing industry and the families who make their living on the water, especially so soon after the loss of Lily Jean in Gloucester, she added. Provincetown manager Alex Morse wrote on Facebook how he was deeply saddened by the boat sinking. Provincetown has a long and proud maritime history, and fishing has always been a central part of the community's identity, he wrote. The fishing community is a close-knit one where the dangers of the sea are well understood and deeply respected. We know the loss of those fellow fishermen will no doubt be deeply felt by many who share that bond. Coast Guard sector, southeastern New England, received a notification just before noon that the vessel Yankee Rose had overturned about 3 nautical miles, or 3.5 miles, northeast of Race Point in Provincetown, Chantry said. Coast Guard crews arrived on the scene along with local agency minutes later, Chantry said. One of the people on board had been transported for medical while the search for the other person is ongoing, Chantry said. The Yankee Rose, docked at a pier, was also the site of a police response on February 26, in which police and firefighters responded to a report of an unresponsive person on board, Provincetown Police Department said in a statement. Responders found two people passed out due to what appeared to be carbon monoxide exposure, Boston radio station WBUR reported. The two people and six other emergency responders and a harbor master was sent to a hospital to be evaluated for carbon monoxide exposure. All eight were discharged the following day. Provincetown is located at the end of Cape Cod, about 115 miles from Boston and 150 miles from Gloucester by car. Top judge is skeptical of change to the MBTA housing law. According to local, acknowledge local opposition can complicate path to compliance. This is by Colin Young, the State House News Service. Judges of the state's highest court do not appear swayed Wednesday by arguments that MBTA community zoning law amounts to an unfounded mandate imposed on municipalities by the legislature. The controversial 2021 law is intended to spur development of housing in more than 100 cities and towns that host or are adjacent to the MBTA service by requiring those communities to adopt at least one zone where multifamily housing is allowed by right. But Marshfield, which sits just south of the southern terminus of the Greenbush Line, sued the State Executive Office of House and Livable Communities, arguing that adopting the zoning mandated by the law forced it to absorb significant incurred costs and expenses in evaluating and drafting proposed zoning bylaws and presenting them to town meeting. A Superior Court judge concluded in June that the possible costs Marshfield did or could face were indirect and that the MBTA Communities Act is therefore not an unfunded mandate. The town appealed that decision to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court and renewed its arguments Wednesday. Marshfield was forced to employ a person to develop modeling. We had no experience applying the compliance regulations. We had to incur expense associated with that, said Robert Galvin, attorney for the town. Justice Dahlia Arguez-Wetlent needled Gavin's appointment and said he was unable to point to language in the law that required the town to conduct modeling to develop at least one reasonably sized zone where multifamily housing would be allowed by right. Galvin conceded under the justice's questioning that Marshfield could have complied with the law by simply allowing multifamily housing in all of its zoning districts, and that the cost of doing so would have been nominal. Our cases say that forcing you to make difficult choices is not a mandate right. Justice Scott Kafker said, earning agreement from Galvin, that's where I lose you. I understand modeling may have been expensive, but you made the choice of a choice to sort of try to accomplish the statute the way as opposed to another. And that seems to fall within our case law that it's not a mandate. Galvin disagreed and argued that the law did not direct us to allow multifamily housing in any district. It directed us to comply to develop a district of reasonable size with density, location requirements, and a whole series of guidelines that I have never seen required in connection with adoption of any zoning bylaw before. This is very unique, and that's what caused the expense to the town of Marshfield, Galvin said. Kafka contended that the town chose to take on expenses that fit within a classical incidental expense, and the fact that it was more expensive was a choice you made. Assistant Attorney General Esme Caramello, headed the AG's Housing Affordability Unit, contended that the MBTA Communities Act is a zoning requirement that does not impose any costs beyond incidental administrative expenses on any municipality. It sort of mandates a state of affairs. To get that state of affairs, some communities, including the community of Marshfield, need to take some action to reach the obligation to meet the obligation, she said, but that action is incidental to the primary obligation. The primary obligation is to have the zoning in place. So those costs, the costs of doing that as has been mentioned in the discussion this morning, are incidental administrative costs. Kafka and Justice Serge Georges both raised the subject of local opposition to the MBTA Communities Act as a factor that potentially complicates matters for local officials. Kafka noted that the regulations around the law are very detailed and also very controversial, and that trying to comply in a way that satisfies both the law and town residents could take in these little towns, their zoning officer may not have the skill to do that. Georges pointed out to Caramello that in a lot of communities where there is local opposition to this, you have to find the right place to have this district. It's not just as easy as we're going to put it here, we're going to put it there, and that's all there is to it. He wanted to know what the limiting principle is here. Caramello responded by saying that most important in the town suit is that the statute does or does not actually impose upon the town. The reality is that neither the statute nor the regulations impose elaborate zoning obligations on towns. They just require, first of all, that the code include multifamily zone and that steps required to do that are pretty simple. If communities want to choose to do it in a different way, and a different way can usually looks like some adding additional policy objectives into the MBTA zone. So, for example, they might wish to put it in a particular part of town. They may wish to add affordability requirements. They might want to avoid certain areas, she said. These are additional policy objectives of the town, and that's fine. In January 2025, the SJC upheld the MBTA Communities Act as a constitutional law that the Attorney General can enforce with legal action. But the High Court also required the Healey administration to redo the regulation-setting process. As of February 10th, 166 of the 177 communities have either come into compliance or submitted and or adopted zoning ordinances intended to comply with the law, according to the Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities. The remaining non-compliant towns are Carver, Draycott, East Bridgewater, Halifax, Holden, Marblehead, Middleton, Rehoboth, Tewksbury, Wilmington, and Winthrop. Though it was signed into law by Republican Governor Charlie Baker, the three Republicans vying to run against Mara Healey this fall have seized on her administration's implementation and enforcement of the MBTA Communities Act as an election year issue. Brian Shortsleeve has pledged to work for a full repeal of the law if he is elected, and Mike Minogue said he actually would cancel unfunded mandates such as the MBTA Communities Act. Mike Kennelly, who helped write the original guidelines for the MBTA Communities Act during his tenure as Baker's Secretary of Housing and Economic Development, has said Healey has weaponized the law against cities and towns. Healey said last month that her administration will not deny or withhold fire safety grants from municipalities that are in non-compliance, similar to a stance she took last year. The seven justices of the Supreme Judicial Court did not offer a timeline for their decision Wednesday. The court says that most cases are generally decided within 130 days of oral arguments, which would mean by the first half of July for cases heard Wednesday. Me, Myself, and Art at Groton's Prescott Center. This is by Kathy Register Groton. Artist Andrea Wilson welcomed the chance to make art with young teenagers at Groton's Prescott Community Center, especially with the goal of improving youth wellness through creative engagement. I just love the middle school. It's this unique little moment in time with big changes, said Wilson. Lots of people say it's a hard age group to work with, and it can be, but in general, these are just kids who are becoming themselves. It's also nice to be part of the process, to witness and help nurture them along in finding themselves and their voices. Wilson designed and led Me, Myself, and Art, a 12-week art school program for 6th, 7th, and 8th graders focusing on journaling and self-portraiture. The focus is on self-portraiture, but with an evolution from strict portraiture into more abstract art as kids continue to express themselves, she said. Her class has created around the idea that making art can have a positive impact on the health and wellness of Wilson's 12 to 14-year-old students. The program is part of the Arts Elevate, a pilot project supported by the Greater Lowell Community Foundation. I think art works well with middle schoolers because it's unstructured, said Wilson. There's no right or wrong. Sometimes teens are used to having to do things in a certain way. They feel that they have to act a certain way or look a certain way. This art class is a chance to just exist. Students can come as they are and feel that that's good enough. Launched in the fall, GLCF's pilot project titled Arts Elevate, Embedded Community Artists for Youth Wellness in Greater Lowell, is a program that incorporates four artists embedded in four nonprofit organizations in Acton, Concord, Lowell, and Groton. GLCF Vice President of Marketing Programs and Strategy, Jennifer Aradia, explained that Arts Elevate initiative was developed for Greater Lowell with the lead funding from BAF Foundation through its Creative Commonwealth initiative. As adolescents report rising levels of stress and isolation, we needed to create timely and accessible pathways to wellness. Arts Elevate recognizes that when young people engage in creative expression, they discover who they are and how they belong. Andrea's work at the Prescott Center shows exactly how powerful that can be for middle schoolers navigating such critical developmental periods, she said. Me, Myself, and Art was an innovation for the Prescott Center, according to Executive Director Megan Donovan. This program is new for us. It's serving up art in a way that addresses youth wellness, she said. Plus, the middle school years are considered one of the most important periods in a child's social development, she added. So we really want to develop more programming for this age, which is typically going through a lot of ups and downs with changes in their bodies and lives. GLCF seeks to raise funds to enable Arts Elevate to be scaled and shared with more nonprofits and artists in the future, and ideally reach more and more adolescents, stressed Aradia. This Arts Elevate pilot is about more than just four embedded artist programs. We're documenting everything that works, what challenges arise, what outcomes we're seeking, so we can create a toolkit that will help other organizations replicate the model. Andrea's journey with these students will inform how arts-based wellness programs can be implemented in nonprofits across the region. For Wilson, who also teaches art at Groton's middle school, the idea of centering her weekly Arts Elevate project around journaling and self-portraiture makes perfect sense. We knew that GLCF's goal was to use the arts as a vehicle to allow these kids to express their emotions in a positive way, so I thought, what better way to see yourself through a self-portrait? Her class began in September with students making accordion-folded journals. They're sketchbooks, really, Wilson said. We start every class with 15 to 20 minutes of painting an emotional landscape on how kids are feeling at that moment. This doesn't need to be a literal landscape. It can be a quick show of color based on how you're feeling. It's a nice documentation of where they are emotionally when they start class that day. As the students continued expressing themselves over the weeks, their artwork gradually evolved from traditional portraits into abstraction. These kids are artists. They're doing all sorts of different things to communicate and share their emotional layers with others. My overall goal is that they look to art as a way to fill an emotional need, said Wilson. And that can be because maybe they're happy or so they'll paint, or maybe they're angry, they will paint. I think that art is expressing yourself. Me, myself, and art concluded with a student-curated art show on December 12th. I knew that I liked these journals to be in the show, Wilson explained, so we intentionally made them accordion fold like Japanese books so they could be displayed as a piece. The journals continue to impress Prescott's executive director. The quality of the work I've seen in these accordion journals is really fantastic, said Donovan. This could be an adult class I'm looking at. And the timing couldn't be better, she added. I feel this is such an important program to be offering right now. It's not just unique and interesting for the kids, but it's really important for them to be exploring these emotions right now at this age, said Donovan. For more further information about the Prescott Center, visit prescottscc.reg.eleyo.com. And for more information on the Greater Lowell Community Foundation Arts Elevate program, or to support the initiative, visit glcffoundation.org/artselevate. And then students introduced to St. Patrick's Chime. This is from Lowell. Two students from Tewksbury Memorial High School took time from their winter vacation to check out the chime at St. Patrick's Church on Suffolk Street. Jamie Keenan and Eric Frazier are both juniors and percussionists. Their Latin teacher, Paul Early, a parishioner at St. Patrick's, arranged for the students to meet with the parish chimer, Anne-Marie Pintel. They were accompanied by Daniel Daly and Eric Donaldson, two teachers from the Wynn Middle School. The chime is part of 11 bells played on a console that is one floor below the bells. The group climbs 62 narrow winding steps to reach the console. The music from the chime can be heard throughout downtown Lowell. Pintel plays the chime before and after the 10 a.m. Mass most Sundays. And there's some pictures of the folks and the picture of the chime. Ghana flag raising, Lowell. In addition to the flags customarily flown at the JFK Plaza, the city commemorates flags from many countries and from many special events during the year. On Saturday, March 7th, from 10:45 till noon, the public is invited to a flag raising ceremony in celebration of Ghana. The outdoor event is held in front of City Hall at 375 Merrimack Street. The event will include traditional songs with drumming, along with several speakers, including Gordon Duncan Helm, Dr. Frank Abaca, Mayor Eric Gichier, Professor Kweze Ampain, and Ken Asafo Adeha, sorry for any mispronunciations, Honorary Consulate of the Republic of Ghana in Massachusetts, among others. For a list of flag-raising dates, visit bit.ly/3L4Y4CC. To schedule a flag-raising ceremony at City Hall, submit an application to the Office of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. 3 to 4 weeks prior to the date of the flag raising. For information, call 978-674-1482 or email rdei@lowellmass.gov. Mill City Grows Sinks Volunteer Board Member. The nonprofit Mill City Grows is accepting application for new board members of its board of directors through March 17th. When considering board applicants, Mill City Grows values the following: lived experience in Lowell or similar communities, people who care about food justice, community health, and equity, organizers, gardeners, parents, educators, and advocates, individuals with skills in finance, law, fundraising, communication, governance, public health, or sustainability, or having a willingness to learn. Immigrants, refugees, longtime residents, and people who have experienced food insecurity. Mill City Grows is deeply committed to equity and inclusion. Prior board experience is not required. For details and an application, visit millcitygrows.org. Democrats to caucus, Drake it. The town Democrats will caucus this month and elect delegates to the 2026 State Democratic Convention in May. On May 21st, Democrats will elect 13 delegates and 4 alternates to represent Drake it at the May event. The caucus will be held at Drake it American Legion Post 315 at 574 Broadway Road beginning at 9 a.m. Registered and pre-registered Democrats in Drake it who are 16 years old by the start of the caucus window on February 19th and pre-registered by the time of their caucus on March 21st may vote and be elected as delegates or alternates during the caucus. Individuals ages 16 to 35 with disabilities, people of color, veterans, and members of the LGBTQ plus community not elected as delegates or alternates may apply to be add-on delegates to the caucus or by visiting massdems.org/caucus-and-convention. The 2026 convention will be held in person. Excuse me. At the DCU Center in Worcester on Friday, May 29th and Saturday, May 30th. Those interested in getting involved with the Drake it Democratic Town Committee should contact Allison Volpe at allisonvolpe@yahoo.com. And that's today in history. 1944, U.S. heavy bombers staged the first scale American raid on Berlin during World War II. 1475, Italian artist and poet Michelangelo was born in Caprese, in the Republic of Florence. 1834, the city of York in Upper Canada was incorporated as Toronto. In 1836, the Alamo in San Antonio, Texas, fell as Mexican forces led by General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna stormed the fortress after a 13-day siege. The battle claimed the lives of the Texan defenders, nearly 200 strong, including William Travis, James Bowie, and Davy Crockett. 1857, the U.S. Supreme Court in Dred Scott v. Sanford ruled 7-2 that Scott, a slave, was not an American citizen and therefore could not sue for his freedom in federal court. 1935, retired Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes died in Washington 2 days before his 94th birthday. In 1964, heavyweight boxing champion Cassius Clay officially changed his name to Muhammad Ali. In 1970, a bomb being built inside the Greenwich Village townhouse by radical weathermen accidentally went off, destroying the house and killing three group members. 1973, Nobel Prize winning Pearl S. Buck, 80, died in Danby, Vermont. 1981, Walter Cronkite signed off for the last time as the principal anchor of the CBS News. 1990, Ed Yielding and Joseph T. Vita flew a Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird spy plane east across the U.S. from coast to coast in a record 67 minutes, 54 seconds. The since-retired U.S. Air Force reconnaissance plane played an outsized role in the American military and intelligence gathering since 1968. 2009, NASA's Kepler Space Telescope has rocketed into space from Cape Canaveral to hunt for Earth-sized planets orbiting distant stars. The spacecraft discovered 2,681 exoplanets outside the solar system before it ran low on fuel and was retired in 2018 after 9.5 years of scouring space for alien worlds. And 2021, Pope Francis met with the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, one of Shiite Islam's most senior clerics, in Iraq's holy city of Najaf to deliver a message of peaceful coexistence, urging Muslims to embrace Iraq's long-beleaguered Christian minority. The historic encounter followed months of negotiations between the Ayatollah's office and the Vatican. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Thank you for listening. Please stay tuned. I'll be back shortly to continue the reading of today's papers. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
More highlights. Three sales give you the money you need to make a dream project happen. You'll accept a responsibility that opens your world. You'll discover new ways to relate to and lead people, which expands a role. Aries and Virgo adore you, and your lucky numbers are 3, 5, 26, 1, and 40. This has been Bob
and Dottie
reading from the March 6th edition of the Boston Herald. We thank you so much for listening and wish you a fabulous Friday. And don't forget to set your clocks ahead this weekend.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, cloudy with rain, temperatures in the middle 30s overnight. Clouds stick around, more rain possible, temperatures dropping down to the mid-30s. And for Saturday, kind of more of the same, mostly cloudy, temperatures in the upper 40s. The sun rose this morning at 6:10, setting at 5:40 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
This is the chef of love, Chef Gennard, TV host and restaurateur. My grandparents harvested their land to sell food and shared its overflowing bounty with our community. Grandma said, for every yam we pick, we give one away. In the world they cultivated, I love preparing and eating dinner with my family on Sundays. When our resources changed, food assistance programs sustained us. They gave me fuel to start my first culinary business at 16 years years old, an inspiration to donate the extra food in my community. Through my life, I've developed an appetite to work with others to ensure everyone has access to the nutritious food we need to thrive. Together, we can help end hunger. Come on, join the movement with Feeding America by volunteering, donating, and advocating. Learn more at feedingamerica.org/act now.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ag Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVAOLP FL, WDJ. Yeah, Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Washington Post. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center reading the Washington Post for Friday, March 6, 2026. Trump removes DHS Secretary Kristi Noem after controversial tenure. By Marianne Levine, Isaac Arnsdorf, Brianna Sachs, and Theodoric Meyer. President Donald Trump said Thursday he is replacing Homeland Security Secretary Kristi L. Noem, a move that came amid mounting bipartisan criticism of her stewardship of the administration's mass deportation agenda and efforts to dismantle the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Trump announced the decision on social media and said Noem would be replaced by Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, Republican of Oklahoma, effective at the end of this month. Noem, he said, will move into a new role as Special Envoy for the Shield of the Americas, which he described as part of a new Western Hemisphere security initiative that will be unveiled at an event in Florida on Saturday. In his post, Trump praised Noem as having served us well and praised her for numerous and spectacular results, especially on the border. Noem has faced increasing uncertainty over whether she would remain in her position as the public soured on her agency's aggressive immigration enforcement and as even some Republicans questioned whether she was fit for the job. Her ouster adds more potential instability to the Department of Homeland Security at a time when the agency remains partially shut down because of an impasse over a funding extension on Capitol Hill, where Democrats are demanding new accountability measures for federal immigration officers. Noem was attending a conference in Nashville when Trump made the announcement, delivering the keynote address at the Sargent Benevolent Association Major Cities Conference. She did not acknowledge her ouster while answering unrelated questions from the audience and reciting what she viewed as the agency's accomplishments in carrying out Trump's agenda, including an alleged 750,000 deportations. She mentioned that she would join Trump and two other cabinet secretaries Saturday to announce an agreement to combat drug cartels. Later, in a social media post, Noem acknowledged her removal from DHS, thanking the president and touting historic accomplishments at the Department of Homeland Security. Mullen, 48, was elected to the Senate in 2022 after spending a decade in the House. He is considered one of the Republican senators closest to Trump. Mullen left a closed-door Senate Republican lunch at 1:26 p.m. and walked out of the Capitol. Trump announced his nomination 15 minutes later on social media while the lunch was still going on. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, said he thought Mullen would bring a fresh set of eyes and a fresh approach to DHS. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, another Trump ally, praised the announcement, saying it was time for a change. Democrats were more circumspect. Senator Angus King, independent of Maine, who caucuses with Democrats, described Mullen as an upgrade, absolutely, from Noem, but said that pretty much anybody is. Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, said that Noem should still be held to account for the corruption that she has shown with the contracting and for violating the constitutional rights of Americans. Over the first 13 months of his second term, Trump did not fire any of his cabinet secretaries, a contrast to the relatively rapid turnover of his first term. Over the same period in 2017-2018, Trump replaced several cabinet secretaries and his chief of staff. The move to replace Noem appeared to come as a surprise to her, as she had told aides that Trump asked her in December to stay through the midterms, according to people familiar with the matter. But Trump told advisers that he had grown increasingly unhappy with Noem after DHS's surge of thousands of immigration enforcement officers in Minnesota in December and January, an escalation that resulted in officers fatally shooting two U.S. citizens, said two people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe the president's conversations. Noem's testimony at a Senate committee oversight hearing this week also rankled Trump, who was displeased with her defense of a $200 million ad campaign that featured Noem and her assertion that Trump had signed off on the campaign, the people said. The Wall Street Journal first reported Trump's frustrations with Noem. During the hearing, Senator John Neely Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana, pressed Noem about the ad campaign, which had been launched not long after she took over at DHS in February 2025. When Kennedy asked if Trump had approved the multi-million-dollar campaign, Noem replied, "Yes, sir, we went through the legal processes," and she said Trump knew about it ahead of time. "It puts the president in a terribly awkward spot," Kennedy told Noem, expressing skepticism that the president would agree to the ad campaign. Kennedy said Thursday that he had spoken with the president Tuesday night and described Trump's recollection about the ads as distinctly different than what Noem had recounted. "The president was not happy, and I remember thinking that the secretary is pretty much dead as fried chicken," Kennedy told reporters after Trump's announcement. During the hearing, lawmakers also repeatedly pressed Noem about her quick pronouncements after the fatal shootings in Minneapolis in January of Renee Good, a mother of three, and Alex Pretty, an ICU nurse, suggesting they had been threatening immigration officers in acts that amounted to domestic terrorism. Democrats, along with a handful of Republicans, lambasted her for quickly jumping to that conclusion before an investigation had been complete. Noem also said Pretty had brandished a gun, though she provided no evidence, and video footage of the shooting contradicted her account. During back-to-back congressional hearings, Noem repeatedly refused to apologize for her statements. Senate Minority Leader Charles E. Schumer, Democrat of New York, said Thursday that he was pleased that Trump had removed Noem, but vowed that Democrats will continue to seek changes to DHS and the administration's immigration enforcement operations. Democrats have demanded that the White House and Republicans agree to a long list of new restrictions on federal immigration officers. The two sides have been negotiating for weeks on a DHS funding deal, but were unable to forge an agreement before the agency closed some operations last month. "It goes beyond one person," Schumer said Thursday. "We need to straighten out the whole agency. The rot there is deep." The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee will hold the hearing on Mullen's nomination.
You're listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab Radio would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. This is Elizabeth. I will now be reading from the Eagle Tribune, dated Friday, March 6th, the headline, "Sprinkled with Love," by Angelina Barabee Haverhill. "There is more to cookies than meets the eye, especially if they're custom-made and used to bring people together during special life moments. For Stacy Welch Andrade, cookies are the vehicle to tell stories and create lasting memories through bold flavors and designs. Welch Andrade, 40, runs Sprinkles by Stacy out of a licensed home kitchen in Haverhill, where she specializes in drop cookies and cookie artistry. French toast, hazelnut churro, white chocolate espresso, and campfire s'mores are some of the flavor profiles provide behind the beautiful scenes decorated with icing and edible printed images. A bride asked her father to bake her a wedding cake by presenting him with a batch of Welch's Andrade cookies that were printed with photos of her and her dad throughout the years and the birthday cake he made for her. If that doesn't melt your heart, Welch Andrade said, the minute she saw it, she started crying, and so did I. There's an emotional connection. Sprinkles by Stacy started out as a food blog created by Welch Andrade when she moved to the Merrimack Valley with her husband and fellow chef Victor Andrade after he took a job in the area following the snowstorms of 2015. Blogging was her way to keep up her culinary skills. She graduated from a culinary arts degree from Johnson & Wales University in North Miami and completed two internships in Germany, which also introduced her to her husband. Welch Andrade worked in high-end kitchens and then transitioned into teaching. Her blog was a way to share her cooking insights and joy of baking while being able to stay home with her two daughters and homeschool them. Fast forward to 2020 and life changed. Her husband was at home and she took her first decorating class. It was her last in-person meeting with a local cookie artist on March 6, 2020, and she fell in love with it. I went home that night and practiced on graham crackers, Welch Andrade said. I was hooked. Then COVID-19 pandemic hit, and she and her husband returned from a cruise to celebrate their 10-year anniversary. It was like a science fiction movie, Welch Andrade said. People began to isolate, and her cookie decorating Her cookie decorating classes moved online, but cookies continued to draw her in. And with her few months of practice, she was ready to make the treat her business. She got her kitchen licensed and permitted in order to bake out of her Haverhill home. By May 17th, 2020, Sprinkles by Stacy was transformed from a blog to a cookie shop. Her first order was for 6 cookies. Delicious by design. Almost 6 years later, Sprinkles by Stacy has grown to offer numerous flavors and options for the palate. Her drop cookies are fun concoctions like banana cream pie, birthday cake, and dark chocolate peanut butter cup. Her sugar cookies are just as mouthwatering with regular and seasonal flavors like apple cider snickerdoodle, brown sugar cinnamon, lemon and sweet cream strawberry. The cookies can be made gluten-free or vegan. Cookies seem like her destiny now, but when Welch Andrade was in the culinary school, she recalled that she had no desire to pursue baking side, and although friends tell her now, they knew this was where she would land. I was always on the hot side of the kitchen, she said. Welch Andrade remembers putting baking soda instead of baking powder into a cake, causing it to rise and then deflate. She would joke about how baking is too much of a science. It tasted like metal, and I'm like, baking is not my forte, she said. But she loved the artwork of cookies. When she was a kid, she enjoyed watercoloring. Her mother pointed out that she now is able to do artwork like she was when she was young, but on a different canvas. Welch Andrade wanted to showcase her background as a chef and highlight flavor in the cookies. Her sugar cookie recipe is a nod to a German butter cookie she would make for her family. It's not super sweet, but when you bite, it's like a lot to eat, she said with a laugh. When she lived and worked in Germany, she was put in pastry department. She said it was the best experience she had ever had, getting to learn all the different cookies and realizing they didn't need to be super sweet, even if back home everybody loves sugar. I just loved that full circle, though, and how it brings me back to baking cookies for my family during the holidays, because that's the only time I would make it, and now I get to share that with everyone, she said. Sprinkles by Stacy is a family affair, and Welch Andrade wouldn't have it any other way. Her daughters, Isabel, 13, and Gabriella, 10, are official taste testers, and she appreciates their brutal honesty at times. She said that being in the kitchen experimenting with different flavors is like being a kid again. Her husband has an Amesbury storefront where he makes plant-based cuisine. Her vegan cookies make appearances at his store, and she says his support has helped grow her business. I'm part of people's lives now, and we have been able to enjoy cookies because their kids may have allergies, and that warms my heart even more, she said. And she likes to think that she also inspired her husband to pursue his passions as well as to be his own boss. In 2021, her cookie business became the family's primary source of income. Andrade, who is from Germany, wanted to open his own place when he first came to the United States. I went into business for myself, and he got to see how happy I was with it as he was figuring out what he wanted to do next, Welch Andrade said. While he was still at his position at a country club, he wanted to work for himself, and now he is much happier working for himself. This past May, Welch Andrade made the switch to plant-based food dyes. She uses no artificial colorings in her icings unless she is making edible printed cookies that have to follow the printer's requirements. It's something I've wanted to do, Welch Andrade said. I'm really curious about where my ingredients come from. Plant-based dyes have been a learning curve for the baker. It takes about 3 days to achieve the perfect red color, so there's more than planning involved. She also uses non-GMO corn syrup, organic sugar, and cage-free eggs. Welch Andrade likes to let her creativity flow when coming up with designs. She said the best way for her to work is for people to send inspirations like their invitations, color palettes, and decorations. From there, I just go with it and have the most fun, she said. While she can be a miracle worker under tight deadlines, the cookies require some love to ensure that they look as good as they taste. It typically takes between 10 days and 2 weeks for cookie orders to be completed. She also offers one-on-one cookie workshops and cookie parties. Any leftover cookies she bakes are donated to local food banks. Looking back on the past several years, Welch Andrade said she would tell her younger self to always keep options open and never say no to exploring new ventures. Life doesn't always turn out the way you exactly pictured it, she said. I never thought I'd be owning my own business while being at home with my kids. I have a wonderful husband, and I thank God I get to do this. Congress doesn't limit war powers. This is by Christian Wade, State House reporter, Boston. Massachusetts congressional delegation joined other Democrats who voted for a war powers resolution to block further military action in Iran, but the effort was narrowly blocked by Republicans. The House of Representatives on Thursday voted to reject a proposal that would have restricted President Donald Trump from continuing the military campaign in the Middle East, contrary now in its sixth day. The resolution failed on a 212-219 vote that went largely along party lines with just two Republicans, Republicans Thomas Massie of Kentucky and Warren Davidson of Ohio, jumping the aisle to vote with the Democrats. The House vote came at a day after the U.S. Senate rejected a similar proposal, also along party lines, with only one Republican, Senator Rand Paul, voting for it. Every member of the Massachusetts 11-member, all Democratic, congressional delegation voted to support the resolution, which Trump vowed to veto if it reached his desk. Representative Seth Moulton, a Salem Democrat, said the president's decision to attack Iran was based on lies, and allowing the war to continue without congressional authority is a gamble on the backs of young Americans who will die in a war that didn't need to happen. It shouldn't be this hard to follow the Constitution, Moulton, and an ex-Marine and Iraq War veteran, said. Donald Trump has been bragging about buildup for weeks, so surprise isn't an excuse. There's no debate that this is a full-on war. The president has said so himself from day one. Senator Ed Markey said he backed the resolution because Trump lied about the rationale for attacking the Middle Eastern country. Markey said the president's claim that the Iran's nuclear and missile programs were an imminent threat were whims and lies, and the war should be halted. Donald Trump is conducting an illegal and reckless war in Iran, Malden, Democrat, said in a statement. Congress has not authorized this war, nor should it, as Trump drags us into a dangerous and unnecessary conflict. It's time to end this war. Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Cambridge Democrat, also voted to support the War Powers resolution to block Trump and Netanyahu's war in Iran. The American people do not support Donald Trump's dragging the United States into yet another endless war in the Middle East, and neither do I, she posted on social media. Republican John Deaton, a former Marine seeking GOP's nomination to challenge Markey on November 3rd election, called out the incumbent senator for hypocrisy for backing the War Powers resolution. He pointed to Markey's vote in support of a War Powers resolution in 2011 after the Democratic President Barack Obama sent troops into Libya as part of a multinational force that led to the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi. Where was Markey's righteous indignation then? Silent as a stone, Deaton said in a statement. Over the decades in office, Markey has never once called out his own party's presidents for overstepping, from unauthorized drone strikes to the military escapades that put our troops at risk without proper oversight. It's always crickets when it comes to Democrats in charge. If approved, the resolution would block additional U.S. military action in Iran without congressional approval under the 1973 War Powers Resolution. The law was passed by Congress during the Vietnam War as a legislative check on executive war authority. The state's congressional delegation support for War Powers Resolution was backed by a group of 28 Democratic state senators who on Thursday sent a letter to their Washington counterparts urging them to continue their opposition to the illegal war. The senators, led by Senate President Karen Spilka, said it's imperative that the body reaffirm Congress's constitutional authority to declare war and authorize the use of military force. The framers of the Constitution entrusted this critical responsibility to the legislative branch to ensure that decisions of such magnitude reflect the collective judgment of the people and their representative, not the unilateral action, executive action. Bid on Searles Estate to be opened on March 23rd. This is by Teddy Toucher Methuen. With under 3 weeks left for prospective buyers to bid on the Searles Estate, Mayor D.J. Beauregard is trying to keep a lid on any potential drama that could impact the process. During a city council meeting Monday, Beauregard said past false allegations about missing artifacts from the estate alongside other actions had cost the city a potential bid from famed artist Hunt Sloman. The city is looking to sell the historic estate for at least $4 million to a buyer who has the resources to maintain the estate, the desire to preserve it, and the willingness to offer a public benefit. Bids will be open March 23rd during the meeting. Beauregard denied a request by City Council Chair Nelly Soto to hold a public meeting to offer councilors a refresher on the estate 5 days before the bids close. He said the meeting should be held after the bids close to be closed to the public. Beauregard also made mention of phone calls made to Sloan that might have scared him off. He did not indicate who made the calls. Soto said the meeting could get new councilors up to speed on the city's plans for the estate and provide an update to veteran members. In a follow-up page-long comment, she said Beauregard was not following through on his promise of collaboration. Soto said she would not hold a meeting without Beauregard on his administration. What I will continue to do is to advocate for transparency and clear communication regarding the status of the property, Soto said. Beauregard was critical of Soto in a comment to the Eagle Tribune months earlier. Soto made mention of the rumors regarding estate artifacts in the resolution that would authorize an audit of the estate. To date, her actions have consistently undercut efforts to restore and preserve the estate. Rushing to hold this meeting before the RFP closes only further jeopardizes the process. Soto said she did not interfere in the process in any way, and a council meeting would not hinder the process. I do not believe transparency discourages legitimate proposals, she said. In fact, clear public information about process expectations and the status of a municipal asset typically strengthens confidence in the process rather than undermines it. Beauregard said Sloneman had instead gone on to buy a historic mansion in Newport, Rhode Island. Sloneman spent $16 million on the purchase, according to media reports. I look at the case as a terrible example of an opportunity lost for the city, Beauregard said. Soto said her goal was simply transparency. If there were any discussions with a specific buyer, it would be responsible for the city council to have been informed, as no such proposal has ever been formally presented to us, she said. Beauregard said he wouldn't be able to divulge if there had been any bids until March 23rd, when proposals will be publicly examined. The city previously extended the bidding by 3 months due to a lack of bids. City Solicitor Paul O'Neill confirmed Monday to officials that at a very least bidding documents had been taken out and prospective bidders had gone on tours. The estate comprises 25 buildings, including a 74-room mansion, and has been assessed at more than $11 million. In the fall of 2024, the city purchased the property for $3.25 million from the Sisters of Presentation of Mary. The purchase also included more than $1 million in artifacts. Since then, officials had sought to find a way to preserve the property, which brings with it maintenance and security costs. The estate was built during the late 19th and 20th century by wealthy interior designer Edward F. Searles. Searles is one of the three wealthy benefactors whose architectural influence can be felt around the city, including the numerous stone walls he left behind. The estate comprises 25 buildings, include a 74-room mansion, and has been assessed at $11 million. In the fall of 2024, the city purchased the property for $3.25 million from the Sisters of Presentation of Mary. Ayotte, New Hampshire Guard deployed amid Iran attacks. This is by Paula Tracy, Concord, New Hampshire. New Hampshire citizen soldiers in the National Guard have been called up following the United States and Israel's attack on Iran 5 days ago, Governor Kelly Ayotte confirmed Wednesday. Ayotte, a Republican, told reporters Wednesday she could not say how many troops or where they were being deployed in Operation Epic Fury, but said she had been in communication with the Trump administration about the deployment and received a classified briefing. She also answered questions about discussions with the Trump administration which led to its abandoning plans to build an ICE detention facility in Merrimack. The New Hampshire National Guard previously had units deployed both domestically and overseas, including border security missions and the first operational KC-46A Pegasus deployment. In recent domestic operations, approximately 2,200 National Guard troops from multiple states, including New Hampshire, were mobilized to Washington, D.C. for security and support missions. They have our full support, and we appreciate them and their families. The state is coordinating with the Pentagon because when you are in an active conflict situation, that messaging, and they are federally activated, we have to take their recommendations on what can be released publicly because we don't want to give the enemy any information that they shouldn't have just to they have to protect 5 days ago. President Trump announced the country and Israel were bombing Iran, and to date there have been six casualties. The president has not ruled out boots on the ground, Ayotte said. Our National Guard has been activated, she said. And in terms of additional details, let me say, first of all, I have such respect for our men and women in our troops. Haverhill, Possible Dreams 2026 to be held Monday at Northern Essex. A visioning session explores 13 great ideas for the city. This is by Jonah Frangiosa, Haverhill. All festivals, farmers markets, and other celebrations must first come from an idea. And on Monday, there's a yearly get-together that allows anyone to share their 2 cents. Team Haverhill's annual community visioning event, Possible Dreams, is set from 7 to 9 on Monday at Northern Essex Community College, 100 Elliott Street. Attendees will meet in the Hotlieb Technology Center on the campus to tune their eyes and ears towards Haverhill's biggest and brightest ideas of 2026. Possible Dreams is designed as a lively community conversation where residents meet new people, network, discover more about Haverhill, and share ideas to shape the city's future. The topic of conversation includes ideas that folks have submitted in advance. These participants will step in front of the crowd to give a pitch with a goal of turning their project into reality that benefits Haverhill. After each presentation, the groups break into small table discussions to explore how each proposition can move forward. For Monday night's event, attendees will hear 13 ideas: Reading Buddies Literacy Financial Literacy Program, Haverhill Family Trail Guide, Haverhill Sister Localities, Haverhill 250th Call for Participation, Haverhill Community Playground, John Greenleaf Whittier Statue, Christmas Market, Bradford Square Beautification, Career Launch Base Camp, Haverhill Museum of the Arts, World Cup Viewing Events, and Edible Perennial Nursery. Kevin Burke, president of Team Haverhill, said the event is an open and non-formal environment that welcomes any resident to say their piece. Everybody contributes in a different way, Burke said. Some people want to volunteer directly. Some people want to have help with their networking. Everybody pitches in whatever way they can to make these ideas happen. Burke said the possible dream typically draws between 130 and 150 attendees, with many longtime locals meshing with newcomers looking to get more involved. Monday night will serve as the launch pad, as Burke described it, for community ideas. This marks the 19th year of Possible Dreams, with many of the of Haverhill's most beloved developments first passing through table talks of this event. Among them is River Ruckus, which now possibly the largest festival in the city, bringing thousands of people to the Riverfront Park each fall. Another example is Let's Hike Haverhill, a series of guided hikes through conserved areas across the city hosted by the Essex County Greenbelt Association. The program entered its fourth year last year, continuing to invite local hikers to trek through the wilderness. Woofstock, an annual dog festival in Bradford, was once an idea pitched at Possible Dreams. Organizers worked with the community members to first develop the concept into what is now a dog-scented festival that pulled hundreds of leashes towards Chris Farm Stand for the past two Septembers. Other impactful projects from past include Clement Farm Disc Golf Course, Little Free Art Galleries, Haverhill Restaurant Week, and the revitalization of Haverhill's Farmers Market. Many of those have bloomed into the city's most well-known events and attractions. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. for refreshments and seating, with the event beginning at 7. The community discussion is free and open to the public. Walk-ins are welcome, though registration isn't covered, online at teamhaverhill.org/possible. Andover Democratic Committee calls caucus. This is Andover. The Andover Democratic Committee announced it will hold a caucus to elect convention delegates at noon on Saturday at the Memorial Hall Library, 2 North Main Street, ahead of the 2026 Massachusetts Democratic Party convention. All registered Democrats are welcome to attend, vote, and run to be a delegate. Unaffiliated voters can change registration upon arrival in order to participate. The Andover Democratic Committee is excited to gather and select delegates to represent our committee in town at a convention. Andover Democratic Committee Chair Matt Chilak said, "Participatory politics is the cornerstone of our democracy, and local grassroots actions like attending a caucus or convention and opportunities for regular people to get involved and have their voices heard. Along with selecting the town's 20 allocated delegates and 4 alternates, it is expected that several candidates for the office, including in the contested 6th congressional district race, will be in attendance at the caucus to make a pitch to Democratic voters. This year's Mass Dems convention will be in Worcester on May 29th and 30th. Delegates at the convention will vote on endorsements for all statewide offices on a primary ballot, including the contested U.S. Senate race and all constitutional officers. In order to appear on the primary ballot, these statewide candidates must first earn 15% of convention votes. Methuen to elect delegates. The Methuen City Democratic Committee will be electing their 23 delegates and 5 alternates to represent the city at 2026 State Democratic Convention at 9 a.m. Saturday at City Hall, 41 Pleasant Street. The convention is set for May 30th in Worcester, according to press release from the committee. The caucus is open to all registered Democrats, and the delegation to the convention will be equally represented, across all genders. In the spirit of inclusion, youth, minorities, and people with disabilities who are not elected as delegate or alternates may apply to be an add-on delegates at the caucus by visiting massdems.org/convention, according to the committee. To get involved with the committee, contact Chairwoman Lisa Yared Ferry or Vice Chair Susan Infantine at sueinfantine@gmail.com. Methuen 300 Orchestra on Saturday. Celebrate Methuen's 300th anniversary with an evening of Hollywood favorites in Hollywood and Methuen from 5 to 10 p.m. on Saturday at Methuen High School, 1 Ranger Road. The tricentennial celebration will feature a performance by Firebird Pops Orchestra, which will play music from Harry Potter's films Jurassic Park, Star Wars, Pirates of the Caribbean, and more. The live performance will be conducted by Brendan J. Kenny, the founder of the Firebird Pops Orchestra. The orchestra was established in 2020 and performs across the greater Boston area. Register for the event at business.haverhillchamber.com. Contact Jill Stackelin at gmail.com with any questions. The Cabot hosts film series on people of color. This is by staff writer Michael McHugh. The Cabot will once again be hosting this month's It's Amplifying Voices free two-day event showcasing films made by and about people of color. First started in 2023, Amplifying Voices aims to bring stories and voices to the North Shore with films curated by Sabrina Aviles, Executive Director of Cine First Latino Boston, and Lisa Simmons, Executive Director of the Roxbury International Film Festival. The event begins on Thursday, March 12th at 7 p.m. with librarians at the documentary by director Kim Snyder. The documentary highlights the efforts of librarians across the country who aim to lay bare the underpinnings of extremism fueling book bans across the U.S. A talk back will follow the film, with more details to be made available closer to the screening. On Friday, March 13th at 8 p.m., the Cabot will screen Paquito de Rivera, From Carne y Frijol to Carnegie Hall, a documentary by director Jaron Mandibal. The film focuses on Paquito de Rivera, a Cuban-born clarinetist, sax player, and composer, and 16-time Grammy and Latin Grammy winner who engages in a variety of musical styles. Filmed in New York, Boston, Wolf Trap, Virginia, Miami, and Uruguay, the film includes collaborations with pianist Chucho Valdez and cellist Yo-Yo Ma, a talkback with Mandelbaum and film composer and guitarist Claudio Ragazzi will immediately follow the screening. The Cabot will present a series of short films on Friday, March 13th from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. The series will begin with Cellist by Marielena Thames, a documentary following the story of 98-year-old cellist as she faces the final stage of life and her nurse Monica, focusing on the monotony and dignity of daily routine elder care. Following Cellist is I Don't Know If You Have Anything to Say Again, a narrative story by directors Victoria Falavina and Thasilo Weber, in which the protagonist Brazil Fernando meets his mother weekly at a cafe. During their encounters, Brazil always tells his mother that he is gay, who has difficulties remembering her son's sexuality as she suffers from Alzheimer's. The Cabot will then screen Aki e Ala, a documentary by director Isabel Breton. Through a conversation with photographer Winston Vargas, the film explores the exploration of the Dominican community and the experience of the diaspora in the Washington Heights neighborhood of New York. Following Aki e Ala will be Roe and Stardust, a narrator by director Eunice Lewis, in which a free-spirited teen fulfills her terminally ill grandmother's dying wish of building a rocket ship to launch her into outer space. Next, the Cabot will screen Sea Charm, a narrative by director Chaney Carlson Bullock, a short silent memorial film honoring the late Dale Bick Carlson, Marvin Olds, and Langston Hughes, and our ancestors. Inspired by Hughes' poem Death of an Old Seaman, the piece plays tribute to Hughes' perspective on our ancestors' connection to the ocean using his poetry as a guide. Cheers and jeers. Jeers to one completely unsurprising effect of the Trump administration's attack on Iran, which has already cost lives of 6 American servicemen and servicewomen and more than 1,000 lives in the Middle East. Already the price of gas is starting to rise in Massachusetts and elsewhere as oil-rich nations and American and international oil companies move to capitalize on the turmoil. The average price of gas has risen to $3.04 a gallon over the past several days, according to AAA Northeast. Elsewhere across the country, the average price was $3.19 as of Wednesday, up 14 cents from last week and 7 cents from Tuesday. Analysts expect prices to rise another 20 to 30 cents a gallon as the burgeoning war in Iran affects other countries in the region. In recent days, for example, Iran has attacked the oil and gas infrastructure in several Middle East oil-exporting countries, including Saudi Arabia. And no oil and gas tankers have been allowed through the Strait of Hormuz since Monday. Nearly one-fifth of the world's supply travels through the passageway between the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman. It's not just prices and the pump that will rise. Higher fuel prices also mean costlier prices for groceries and other essentials as fuel prices go up, the cost being passed along to you, the consumer. We have a president to thank. Andover resident Jerry Spinney told Eagle Tribune reporter Teddy Toucher as she will be filling her gas tank earlier this week. Candidate Trump promised as he would not get the United States tangled in foreign wars. He also promised lower gas prices and groceries. OPEC sets the gas prices, not us, she said. Why on earth would you not think gas prices would go up? Cheers to jumping off the tightrope for a good cause. Gloucester was understandably devastated by the loss of 7 souls, 6 fishermen, and fisheries observer when the fishing vessel Lily Jean went down 25 miles off the city's coast January 30th. It was a community tragedy, but also a deeply personal one for the families of those lost on the Lily Jean. Captain Gus Sanfilippo, Paul Bell, and his son Paul Beale Jr., John Rosandis, Freeman Short, and Jada Summit. So it is somehow fitting, given Gloucester's rough and tumble image, that a group of pro wrestlers came together last weekend to raise money for the families affected by the tragedy. Gloucester is a very interconnected and very tight-knit, and even though we didn't know the people that passed away, my son and I just felt like we had to do something, wrestler Matthew McGee told the Gloucester Daily Times. McGee is a founder and owner of Outlaw Championship Wrestling, which staged a series of bouts Saturday night at Brown's Mall, a stone's throw from the working waterfront. We wanted to do something for Lily Jean. Families and wrestling fans are always very giving, said McGee, a Gloucester native who grew up in Philadelphia before moving back to his birthplace. Gloucester residents are giving too, and by my measure, the fundraiser was a success, bringing the community together and maybe easing the burdens of those still dealing with loss. And now we'll move over to Dear Abby. Mom is on the hook for a strange son's college loan. Dear Abby, my son took out a couple of education loans, which I co-signed when he was starting college 10 years ago. A couple of years ago, I found out from someone else that he never finished college. When I confronted him, he mentioned that he intends to finish college and is working towards it. He did not mention how many credits he has completed, what made him quit, or why he didn't consult me before dropping out. Shortly after the conversation, he stopped talking to or visiting me for a different reason. We haven't seen each other in 2 years. Recently, I received a notice from a debt collector regarding the loan. I tried to contact my son to figure out what he plans to do about the payments, but to no avail. He has always had terrible money habits. Until he stopped talking to me, he relied on me to rescue him whenever he got into money trouble. I had to pay off another of his educational loans when he started defaulting a few years back. Because of all of this, he owes me a significant amount of money. I am at an age where it is important that I build my retirement fund. If I have to pay off this loan, it will put a big dent in my savings. A few people have recommended I take legal action against him. I am, however, reluctant to do so for fear of severing my relationship with him forever. Is there a less aggressive way to have him take accountability for this loan? Signed, Mom on the Hook. Dear Mom, face it, Mom. The son you have bailed out repeatedly is a deadbeat. He is avoiding you because he has no intentions of paying back the money for which you so caringly co-signed 10 years ago. Contact an attorney and see what your options may be. Doing that is not aggressive or punitive. It may give you a roadmap to pull yourself out of this hole. Dear Abby, I recently saw a TV commercial in which a family of four was sitting at a table in a restaurant. The two kids were watching their parents text on their phones instead of socializing with each other and making pleasant conversation. It made me furious. Why? I was taught that it was disrespectful not to give people your exclusive, undivided attention, and that there is a time and place for everything. I think it's one of the reasons why so many people today lack appropriate social skills. Do you agree? Signed, Present in Rhode Island. Dear Present, I agree with you 100%. What you saw in that commercial was a textbook example of lazy parenting. You cannot teach young people communication skills without modeling them. This was a subject of concern for educators and behavioral specialists for the last 30 years. The result has been generations of adults who have trouble making eye contact when trying to relate with others. Today in history, this is in the... Oh, I guess it's a lot. Oh, no. There's a lot of different things on this one, I believe. March 6th, the 65th day of 2026, and there are 300 days left in the year. Today in history, March 6, 1857, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Dred Scott versus Sanford decision ruled that Scott, an enslaved person, was not a U.S. citizen and therefore could not sue for the freedom in federal court. It is also ruled that slavery could not be banned from any federal territory. The decision deepened the national divide over slavery in the years up until the Civil War. Also on this date, President James Monroe signed the Missouri Compromise, which allowed Missouri to join the Union as a slave state and Maine to join as a free state while banning slavery in the northern portion of the northern of the Louisiana Territory. In 1836, the Alamo in San Antonio, Texas, fell as Mexican forces led by General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna stormed the fortress after a 13-day siege. The battle claimed lives of all Texan defenders, including William Travis, James Bowie, and Davy Crockett. In 1869, chemist Dmitri Mendeleev introduced his concept of the periodic table of elements at a meeting of the Russian Chemical Society in St. Petersburg. In 1912, Oreo cookies were first introduced by the National Biscuit Company, later known as Nabisco. In 1951, the trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg on federal espionage charges began in New York. Both were subsequently found guilty, sentenced to death, and then executed in 1953. In 1964, heavyweight boxing champion Cassius Clay took the name given to him by the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad, or Muhammad Ali. In 1970, a bomb being built inside a townhouse in New York, Greenwich Village, by the members of the underground militant leftist group, accidentally exploded, destroying the house and killing three group members. In 1981, Walter Cronkite signed off for the last time after nearly two decades as the anchor of the CBS Evening News. In 1990, Ed Yielding and Joseph Vita flew a Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird spy plane across the U.S. from coast to coast in record 67 minutes and 54 seconds. The since-retired U.S. Air Force reconnaissance plane played an outside role in American military and intelligence gathering since 1968. In 2009, NASA's Kepler Space Telescope was rocketed into space from Cape Canaveral to hunt for Earth-sized planets orbiting distant stars. The spacecraft discovered 2,681 exoplanets outside the solar system before it ran low on fuel. And today's birthdays, former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan is 100, former Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshnikova is 89, opera singer Carrie Tijuana is 82, rock musician Dave Gilmour of Pink Floyd is 80, actor-comedian Tom Arnold is 67, actor-comedian D.L. Hughley is 63, actor Connie Britton is 59, Basketball Hall of Famer Shaquille O'Neal is 54, rapper producer Tyler, the Creator, is 35, and Millicent Simmons is 23. Thank you for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to the Lab Radio. Request a specialized receiver, or for more information or about the radio reading, call us at lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lowell Association for the Blind by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Or visit our website where you can tune in at Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Elizabeth. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll be back next week to continue the radio reading of local newspapers. Thank you for listening. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.